Hello and welcome. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, Paige Nick. And have we got a show for you today, or have we got a show for you? This is all sponsored by Exclusive Books, and we've got a jam-packed program, so stick around. We're going to start off with Twangy Kalula telling us about a book called Careless People. This is a memoir by Sarah Wynne Williams, and this is about her time spent working at Facebook. This is a new tell-all memoir that's taking the world by storm. After that, Beryl Eichenberger reviews my new novel, Book People, and I'm really hoping she liked it. And then Beverly Rose Miller, we get into an interview. Beverly Rose Miller chats to Gavin Edwards, the author of a book called White Supremacy, A Brief History of Hatred, which sounds fascinating. Our next interview after that is Philip Todras chatting to architect John Stewart about his new biography on the iconic architect Sir Herbert Baker. And then we're going to wrap up the show with a big feature where Philip Todras again chats to Vanessa Falcon and Karen Goodkin about the Jewish Literary Festival, which is taking place right here in Cape Town on the 28th of April. And they're going to give us a taste of what's coming up on the show. And they're going to give us a taste of what's coming up in the festival, so you know what tickets to go and book straight away. This festival gets super booked up, so have a pen and paper ready and listen out for some of your favorites. We don't have a second to waste. So first up, Twangy Kalula is here, and he's reviewing a book called Careless People, a cautionary tale of power, greed, and lost idealism. This is a memoir, as I mentioned, by Sarah Wynne Williams. It's an explosive memoir. It charts this one woman's career at the heart of one of the most influential companies on the planet. Careless People gives you a front row seat to Facebook, these big decisions that have shaped world events in recent decades, and the people who made these decisions. Twangy, welcome to the show. Tell us about Careless People.
Few things are as exciting to me as a book that has been embargoed. It takes me back to those days of a new midnight Harry Potter release or an explosive new book that rattles the news wires like Jacques Poe's The President's Keepers. Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams arrived on bookshelves amid a lot of fanfare in March. It was positioned as an explosive corporate tell-all by a former executive at Facebook. Now, Sarah Wynne Williams is a former diplomat from New Zealand, and she was the director of public policy at Facebook, a job that she lobbied for and created as the firm realized it would need to cozy up to politicians around the world in order to continue to achieve exponential growth. So from 2011 to 2017, she traveled the world with the company's leaders, trying to ensure that Facebook benefited as politicians grappled with how to regulate this new form of media that was on everyone's phones. This was as Facebook proved instrumental in everything from the Arab Spring, which you'll remember, to influencing election outcomes all the way until Trump's first term. The book starts off by explaining how being attacked by a shark as a child made her unbelievably ambitious. And then she delves into how she found herself swimming with sharks of a corporate kind in the most senior boardrooms at Facebook's HQ. She takes us on a rapid ride from the early days when Facebook was a booming startup and tended to adopt the notion of we will build as we fly to, of course, its memorable IPO and then becoming a corporate superpower. Now, as one would expect, the top brass at Facebook are not happy about this book. In fact, they've taken aim at its author and have attempted to stop the book from being promoted. And for good reason. For one thing, the two most famous execs there, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, don't come across very well in this book. In fact, Sandberg is portrayed more as a Devil Wears Prada type of character than the inspiring author of the Lean In Revolution that she led a number of years ago. And Zuckerberg has few saving graces. He's portrayed as cutthroat and careless. But perhaps what's even more damaging is the fact that it exposes the disdain and disregard that powerful executives at Facebook have for political leaders, particularly beyond the US. And it also showcases the lack of responsibility they tend to take for the impact their platforms have had on the world in terms of shaping politics and policies, fueling hate speech and spreading misinformation. Now, I still recall opening my Facebook account almost 20 years ago. It's really hard to believe, when it was still a college experiment with the aim of connecting people. Today, it is an enormous company. It trades as Meta Platforms. It has swallowed up companies like WhatsApp and Instagram. And for all the joy and career success the company has brought when it comes to communication, and social media. It has also been accused of various data abuses and political interference. And the author holds nothing back in explaining why this is the case and why power, greed, and oodles of money ultimately corrupt. But to be fair, there is nothing surprising about what she shares. I think there are very few of us who would think that a company like Meta has the greater good of mankind as its top priority. That said, I found it fascinating to read an insider's account, and it was made better by the fact that it was laced with dark humor and that it's deeply amusing in parts. I really enjoyed it. Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams was published by Pan Macmillan and retails for 409 Rand.
Thank you so much, Twangy. This book was under embargo right up until it was published, and now it's making a big splash. While we're on the subject of Facebook, here's something that's same-same but completely different. Beryl Eichenberger is here to chat about my new novel. It's called Book People, and it's also set in Facebook, although in an entirely different way. This is a novel, and Beryl had a read, and I'm really hoping she liked it. What did you make of it, Beryl? I promise we can still be friends if you didn't like it.
It's been a while since we've seen a book by novelist, columnist, advertising copywriter, and FMR Book Choice host and editor, Paige Nick. So it was with delight that I welcomed her newest novel, Book People. Always up there with current trends, Nick takes us into the world of online book clubs. No wine, but some whine, with an H. It's all about the books. Or is it? As the founder of the hugely successful Good Book Appreciation Society, GBAS, on Facebook, based in SA, Nick has taken this book club, placed it in the UK, and with her wonderfully humorous pen, written a riotous story around it. I am one of the more than 23,000 members who regularly refer to this page for new reads, soaking up the comments from the subscribers. Because there are strict rules to posting, I rarely detect dissension, and certainly no self-promotion. Yes, I know admins can remove posts if rules are broken. So perhaps it's those posts that prompted Nick to bring us this hilarious novel. The swiftly whipped away comments that could cause a furor. With tongue firmly in cheek, this is a look at how, when folk don't know when to shut up, social media can ignite a storm, spawning a sizzlingly funny story that we can all easily relate to. I sailed through it. All the right ingredients for the perfect book club read, along with that glass of wine. Nick has aced it with her imaginative style, irreverence, and acute observations. Nothing escapes her sharp eye. Her characters are shaped around their comments. She rounds them out, giving them lives that are slightly larger than life, but oh so relatable. She builds a story through their landscapes in a modern, quirky, easy-to-read layout. When escalating tempers lead to plots of murderous revenge, there's no telling where this might go. It's almost a thriller, with twists and turns never predictable. Takes a real talent to write humour, and Nick has that in buckets. Hateful Harry Shields, as I dubbed him, is an author who shamelessly self-promotes his books on GBAS. That, and having a couple of alter egos to promote on his behalf. Narcissistic, smug and self-satisfied, married to the long-suffering, but not for much longer, surgeon, Victoria. Bookaholic accountant Norma Jacobs started GBS some years ago, and with a membership of some 13,000, this is her happy place. Boyfriend Steve is a gamer and so-called writer, suffering from writer's block. He's a sloth of note, living off Norma and thoroughly unlikable. His reaction when Norma drops a big, ego-deflating bombshell, no spoilers, and that she has changed her well-paid job to become the oldest, poorly paid intern in the publishing industry, is less than supportive. But all hell breaks loose when someone, apparently an elderly member, posts a scathing review of Harry's crime novels. Unable to ignore this, Harry goes into meltdown mode, deranged possibly the better word, and the comments fly. Harry just can't let go, and as membership soars, so do tempers. Relationships teeter on the brink, revenge plans send Harry down a rabbit hole. The page goes viral. Harry is persona non grata. Cancelled. And when a member ends up in a coma and the cops are brought in, who done it? A delightful romp, opening up all the pitfalls of airing your views on social media and the calamitous results that could result. My signs of a good read are my reactions. So when you see me chortling happily, or perhaps in extreme cases, slamming the book and groaning outwardly at a character's antics, that, my friends, is a recommendation. There were extreme reactions to this one, making it a deliciously satisfying read. So stop your doom scrolling. Pick this up for a respite. I learned a lot about Facebook habits, trolling and the like, adding some potent words to my dictionary. Was forced to look at book talk, and I'm all round aiming to sound smarter about this new speak. But most of all, I get what cancel culture really means. Ouch! Book People is a real winner.
Was Meadowlands by the Afro Tenors, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio, sponsored by Exclusive Books, with me, your host, Paige Nick. We've got an interview coming up next. Beverly Ruiz-Miller is here, and she's going to be chatting to Gavin Edwards about his new book. It's called White Supremacy, A Brief History of Hatred. And Gavin is here in Cape Town to launch this new book. Welcome to the show, Beverly Ruiz Miller and Gavin Edwards.
Really glad to welcome an old friend, Gavin Evans, to the studio today. He's an author and an academic, the author of 10 books of nonfiction. He lectures at the University of London and is a member of the Royal Institution's Challenging Pseudoscience Group, a committed activist whom I think I last met in Lusaka. His slightly unexpected interest in boxing produced a wonderful book that I love very much called Boxing Shoes is Dead. And he is married to author Margie Orford. He is in Cape Town to launch his 10th book, a short and intense book titled White Supremacy, A Brief History of Hatred. Welcome, Gavin.
Thank you very much.
Gavin, the wonderful thing about this book, which has a difficult title, not a difficult title, but one that is a sort of a quite challenging, is how easy it is to read. You know, you have done your old training as a journalist has done, you know, really done you proud. And that you take difficult concepts in history and you make them really accessible. And it couldn't be more timely, as the notion of white supremacy and its current form, the Great Replacements Theory, is on the rise again, magnified by global events as we're seeing play out right now. Explain to us what the Great Replacement Theory is.
So it really goes back about 150 years to the founders of eugenics, who was mainly the cousin of Darwin, Francis Galton, although Darwin himself was increasingly racist as he got older and started to talk in those terms. And he believed that the white population was being replaced by faster breeding populations of lower intelligence. So he had a program where he advocated sterilization of kind of lower grade white people who he felt were less intelligent, and the elimination of black people. And that eugenics program became the kind of conventional wisdom throughout, well, Britain, Europe, and the United States, and also Japan, up until the end of the Second World War, when the consequences of eugenics, which is the Holocaust, became apparent to everyone. So it kind of lulled for a few decades. It's come back, both in the form of a revival of race science, but closely related to that, this idea that white Americans were being replaced as a plot. Often George Soros is seen as being behind the plot, usually very often finding a Jewish notable to be behind the plot, by Hispanic and black people, and in Europe by Muslim people. And this was a view of the far right, and was became known as the alt-right, alt because they were mainly online. But since then, it's kind of burst its banks, and it's become more mainstream. People like Tucker Carlson have been talking about it. People like Stephen Miller, who works for Trump, and Trump himself. So it's become a mainstream idea, which makes it even more worrying. But it also makes the book more timely.
That's what I thought all the way through. And it's important to note here two things, one of which is you do give some of the victims a voice in this book. You know, you take white killings of people of other colors, of backgrounds, and so on. You do actually lay out some of those case histories in the book. What interested me also was that this idea seems to have gained traction where they're able to hold two contradictory theories at the same time. They hate Muslims, but they also hate Jews. And increasingly, women's place should be in the home and as mothers, and some of them even say women shouldn't have the vote. And that's actually terrifying.
There are a lot of contradictions in the ideas and in the alt-right. I mean, generally, I mean, on you mentioned the thing of hating Muslims and hating Jews. I mean, many of them are vehemently anti-Semitic but pro-Israel. So there's that. But you've got people who are fundamentalist Christians and who are atheists. Sam Harris, for example, has supported race science, prominent atheist writer. You've got people who come from the kind of woo-woo alternative sector who've become very worried about being vaccinated. And then the result of that, when COVID came, they kind of went down a rabbit hole, and some of them ended up as full-on alt-right people. So it's very contradictory. There are people from all over the place.
We haven't got very long, and I really want to unpack this book more, but I do have to mention the whole case of going on at the moment of the false notion of South African farm murders, where, in fact, you point out in the book that whites are the safest group in South Africa.
Mm. So, I mean, in terms of the farm murders, I mean, I looked at all the figures of it. And yes, I mean, the farm murders are terrible, but it's a very tiny proportion. And they're not political. They're carried out by young criminals. And the numbers of farm murders have been declining. So the idea that has been put forward of white genocide in South Africa is nonsense. But it's a convenient nonsense, both for the people who are promoting it here, but also for the alt-right in America, because South Africa then becomes a kind of cause célèbre that they can take up.
Just my final question to you. There is some good news, first of all, that the racial hatred is in fact overall dropping, particularly amongst younger people. So I think we should actually point that out as well. But your worrying prediction is that for the great replacement theory to work, disturbed young white males, basically, only need to read the falsehoods, and so much of it is wrong, almost all of it is wrong, and get hold of guns for the tinderbox to explode. Mm. So that's incredibly troubling.
It's very troubling. And on the thing of young men, the gap between the attitudes of young men and young women is growing all over the United States and in Europe. And the worrying thing is with young men and rifles.
For anyone who wants to understand the long road to how we got to this difficult place and where it might go, I think this book is laid out in an easily digestible form. And it's profoundly important. I cannot recommend White Supremacy by Gavin Evans highly enough, published by Jonathan Ball. Thank you, Gavin.
Thanks very much, Beverly.
You were just listening to Sweet Dreams Are Made of This by the Busquets Soweto String Ensemble. I tell you what else Sweet Dreams are made of. Every 2 weeks I bring out this show, which means that every 2 weeks I get to work closely with Mzu Makete. Mzu compiles all the music for today's show and every show. He also strings our entire show together and makes us sound good. He takes out all the fluffs, all the mistakes we make, and he makes us sound a lot smarter than we really are. Or at least he makes me sound a lot smarter than I really am. So this is a side note. If you'll excuse me, listeners, this is a note for our station manager, Ion DeForce, and for Wesley, our programming manager. You guys, you've got a gem in Mzu. Couldn't dream of working with a nicer guy. Right, back to the show. Listeners, readers, we've got another wonderful interview coming up for you. Philip Todros was in the studio and he was chatting to architect John Stewart about a big new biography that's just come out about iconic architect Sir Herbert Baker. South Africa is lucky enough to be graced with many Sir Herbert Baker buildings, and this biography delves into the life and times of this iconic architect.
Sir Herbert Baker, a biography by John Stewart. And I have the man himself, I'm talking about John Stewart, with me today. And John, you're an architect.
I am indeed.
So I understand that this might have been one of the motivations. What got you into the subject particularly?
Well, I've been coming across Baker's work for years. And his reputation in the UK is slightly different from his reputation in South Africa. He's not regarded as one of our leading architects. And I was always rather surprised, because whenever I encountered his work, I thought, actually, this is outstanding. And so I got to the position where I thought, I think he's due, first of all, as an important architect, he's due a biography, which he doesn't have, covering the whole of his career. And secondly, there's a bit of a wrong to be righted, in my opinion. I think he deserves to have a much stronger reputation internationally than he does at the moment.
Also, I mean, he's relatively current. I mean, 1862, but 1946 is when he died, so mm-hmm. It's not that long ago. But why was his reputation a bit, you know, shaky? This whole imperial background, perhaps, or were the other ramifications, particularly what happened in England itself?
Yeah, I mean, you would think it might be the links to the empire, or is the fact that Cecil Rhodes was one of his most significant clients in the early days. But actually, it's more two other things. I mean, one, he rebuilt the Bank of England in London. Now, the fact that he got the job meant that he was an outstanding architect, and his contemporaries saw that quite clearly. But the reality was that to recreate the bank, he had to demolish the existing buildings. And a lot of people are very concerned with the loss of those buildings. And it really took until about 20 years after Baker's death for Nicholas Pevsner, a very well-known architectural critic, to say that the demolition of the old bank was the greatest architectural crime in the City of London in the 20th century. Well, that stuff just hangs on your back like an albatross. So there was that was a problem. And secondly, he'd fallen out with his partner, Sir Edwin Lutyens, while building New Delhi. And Lutyens took it very badly and really went out of his way to damage Baker's reputation as much as he could. So I think those, combined with the general lack of interest by modernists in that period, has meant that he's very slowly just drifted into a little bit of an oblivion in the UK.
But also, I think you also had the luck of having access to materials that had not been available before.
Oh, absolutely. No, I was incredibly lucky, because there's a lot of information on Baker at the Royal Institute of British Architects, and I was working my way through that quite happily. And then I thought, well, it would be good to contact his family if I can. And so I got in touch with his eldest grandson, Michael. And Michael said, well, we've got a few things. Come down to the house in Bristol. So I went down, we had a coffee, and he said, well, come on, I'll show you what I've got. So I was expecting maybe a couple of photograph albums or something like that. We went up two floors and into this office, in which the walls were lined with files. And Michael said, well, what would you like to see first? I've got all the letters from Sir Herbert to his brother while he was in Cape Town. I've got all the letters from Sir Herbert to his wife while he was in India. I've got the letters from Herbert to his mother while he was on his European tour. I was absolutely flabbergasted. And so I had access to material no other author who'd written on Baker before had. And it allowed me, I hope, to bring something really of Baker himself into the book, as well as it being an architectural biography.
I think what's also important to me is the extent of his practice, not only in London, but then in South Africa, then in Delhi, then in France with the war commissions.
Yes.
How did he actually manage this? We're not talking about Zoom. We're not talking about airlines. How actually did he physically manage to do that?
I as an architect myself, I find it incredible. I mean, when you just consider that in building New Delhi, for example, all the drawings were done in London. So the buildings were drawn in London. They then went on a steamship for 6 weeks to get to India. He had a local architect or member of his team in Delhi who would interpret them and pass them on to the contractor. And then every winter, Lutyens and Baker would go out to Delhi for 3 months, have discussions with the viceroy in developing ideas and attempt to maintain control of the quality of construction on site. A huge undertaking. And then you consider that while he's doing that, he's also building in London. And in fact, the Delhi buildings overlapped with the rebuilding of the Bank of England and with South Africa House and India House in London. It's just staggering. And through the early 20s, all of that was happening in addition to him being one of the architects to the Imperial Wargrave Commission.
Yeah, I just can't actually imagine it. You know, he's based in London. He comes out to South Africa. He's got to get from Cape Town up to Kimberley one stage and then also to Johannesburg.
Yeah.
He then comes back to Cape Town, goes back to London to go to Delhi. From Delhi he comes back. I mean, I found that extraordinary. But as one of the comments was, he had an extraordinary enthusiasm for life.
Yes.
He must have had to be able to accomplish all of that. And just very briefly, some of the highlights that you discovered, rediscovered in South Africa, because I think we, besides the Union buildings, Cape Town itself is a treasure chest of
Nika. No, absolutely. A whole range of Sir Herbert's buildings in Cape Town, because this is where he built his first architectural practice. He'd started to work in Gravesend near Kent, near his hometown, and he established a very small practice. But when he came to Cape Town, he then had the opportunity to work for Cecil Rhodes.
And that meant Croesus Skier.
Yeah, indeed. And that
we're talking about the manor house and not the hospital.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And that transformed his career. He became Rhodes architect, known as such, and the work just started to flood in.
Well, it's quite a book. It's quite an accomplishment. And it's a huge volume to really get through. So we've just been speaking to John Stewart, himself an architect, about Sir Herbert Baker, a biography published by Jonathan Ball Publishers.
Thank you so much, Philip, for that fantastic interview. Listener, if you miss any part of our show today, maybe you've just tuned in and you've missed a little piece, or maybe somebody mentioned a book on the show and you didn't manage to catch it, we can go quite fast because we've got such a jam-packed show. And I also want to say, if Ian, our station manager, and Wesley, our programming manager, didn't hear me giving Mzu all the creds he's due, then you can tune in to fmr.co.za and find this show. We load it as a podcast straight after the show, and you can have a listen back and see what you missed. We've got a track coming up now, and it's Ma Cherie by Freshly Ground. No, for
Zele, se
That was Ma Cherie by Freshly Ground, and you are tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, my music maestro, Mzuma Keta, and all our reviewers and interviewers. And this show is so proudly sponsored by Exclusive Books. We're really lucky to have you guys. We've got a really cool segment coming up for you now as we head to the end of the show. We've invited Vanessa Falcon and Karen Goodkin into the show to chat to Philip Todras about the Jewish Literary Festival, which is coming up in Cape Town on the 28th of April, which is Freedom Day. It's a public holiday. So you are free to join us at this wonderful festival and come and listen to some of your favorite authors chatting about the books they've written. They've also got new segments on filmmakers and so much more. There's everything from humor to politics. And that's why we've invited the organizers of this festival into the studio to chat to Philip Todras and give you a little taste of what's coming up at the Jewish Literary Festival this year. Because you have to be really selective and pick who you want to see. They have a jam-packed program and you can only see one at a time, sadly. So you have to pick a lane, book some tickets, and come and join us at the festival. It's a wonderful day out. You'll see lots of people. You'll hear lots of amazing things. I'm going to hand over now to Philip Todras and to the Jewish Literary Festival team, Vanessa Falcon and Karen Goodkin, to tell us all about it. Welcome to the show, you guys.
The Jewish Literary Festival is due on the 28th of April. And that's Freedom Day. Well, you have to pay a little to get in, but boy, you've got a free choice of some amazing things to do. And I have with me Vanessa Falcon and Karen Goodkin, the co-chairs. And Vanessa, let's start with you. What can we anticipate?
We have another amazing lineup, at least we think so, for our festival this year. Our headline international author is the well-known British comedian and children's author, author of a book called Jews Don't Count, and his latest book, My Family. I'm speaking about David Baddiel. He's coming especially for the festival. He will be closing it up. He's one of our highlights. Another highlight is Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, podcaster, and author of The Escape Artist. He'll be on Zoom with us the Thursday before the festival. We have some other wonderful visitors. Nadia Bilchik used to be a SABC anchor, has worked at CNN, lives in Atlanta. She's coming especially. She will be interviewing David. Those are some of our headline authors. Maybe Karen wants to speak a bit more about
some of our local authors. As usual, we love to use the festival as a way to highlight the incredible local talent that we have in South Africa. So some of my favorites are, we have a session where the psychologist Dorrie Wheel will speak to two memoirists, Nikki Munitz, who wrote Fraud, and Lou Geffen, who wrote Bearing My Soul, about just what it takes to write your life story and tell things to the public that are difficult for you. We also, very interesting this year, for the first time, we have filmmakers, and we have a panel on film as text. And archivist Romy Kaplan will speak to well-known local filmmakers Gabriella Blumberg, Hilton Tannenbaum, and Ari Kruger, who most of us know as the creator of Suzelle DIY and Tully Babes. So that's a really good first for us. We also look at self-publishing. What does it take? What makes you convinced that you have a story that is worthy to tell, and then that you feel so strongly about it that you publish it yourself? And FMR's own Beryl Eichenberger will be speaking to Irene Berman, Angela Rothbart, Joelle Searle, and Debbie Rozovsky about books that they just felt they had to publish.
To continue, what we have for the first time at the festival is a virtual room only, where we will have an interviewer either in person or on Zoom speaking to, for example, renowned ENT Peter Friedland, who was Nelson Mandela's doctor, and he's written a book, What I Learned from Madiba. He co-wrote it with his sister Jill Margot, and they will be chatting to us from Sydney and Perth.
And in fact, he was in South Africa, and I interviewed him for Book Choice.
Oh, wow.
Very, very remarkable person, too.
Another, what should be an amusing session, is Jonathan Anser speaking to journalist Roy Issacovitz about his book on Michael Medjak, who was a high-flying drug peddler who was found out that he was in trouble with the law when he saw his boat on CNN. He was a local South African who landed up in Toronto. His book's called High Time, Antics of a Larger-than-Life Drug Smuggler. I think will be a very meaningful, sentimental session where Peter Godwin, who is a prize-winning author who's on book tours around the world now, will speak to Women's Zone's Nancy Richard about his latest book called Exit Wounds.
And our very own Philip Todres will interview the author Richard Zimler about his fascinating historical fiction novel called The Incandescent Threads.
And I must add, it's a remarkable read by a remarkable man. And if you want to know what an incandescent thread is, I think you need to look at the author himself as one of those people who brings things together
in remarkable ways.
And I can't wait to actually, we've been in correspondence over some time, and now we'll actually be, inverted commas, meeting on Zoom.
Virtually. We also have some politics. We have Jonathan Anser and his book, Bullshit, about the lies that politicians tell. And I'm sure he will tell us about some more political fabrications that have happened since the publication of the book. And another first, Tony Leon will be speaking for the first time about his memoir, which is called Being There, Backstories from the Political Front. So a little bit more of the behind-the-scenes stories of what goes on.
He's no longer in the background anymore. He's very much in the foreground.
Very much.
We also have former UCT Vice Chancellor Max Price talking about his book, Statues and Storms, Leading Through Times of Change. He'll be speaking with Jonathan Armid.
And we have to have some lightness and humor. So we have FMR's Paige Nick speaking to her friend and co-author Diane Auerbach, each of whom have recently put out a humorous book. Paige's is called The Book People, and Diane's is called Tears Before Bedtime. And they will have a sort of a riff between them about these humorous books and look at writing humor and what that takes.
And that's Paige
doing
the show.
Book show.
So, boy, are we proud of that.
Absolutely. And then we have some quite useful sessions. We've got one called Work Well, Live Well. We've got life coach Judy Klippen, therapist Noah Belling, and Marion Scher, author journalist, telling us how to maintain our sanity and mental health in the workplace.
There's something also for people who are fascinated by business and what makes businesses succeed. Our session is called the From Connections to Growth, Strategies for Networking and Scaling Your Business. And local businesswoman Lara Rosmarin will talk to Prof. Sandra Vanamerva and Nadia Bilchik, who each have books on different aspects of business success. And I think what will be a firm favorite is Arthur Goldstuck, who has written a book on AI, What You Need to Know, and he will be talking to JLF stalwart Gus Silber.
Well, I think what we also need to know is how the program is structured, because there's several sessions, and the only problem that I do have with the True Festival is which one do I go to at a particular time? So just give us the structure, and then I think very importantly, how to book, because it's generally a full house event, so do tell us more about the structure.
Well, it's quite heart-wrenching for us because we put a lot of time, blood, sweat, and tears and love into this program, and five sessions run at a time. So it becomes quite difficult for our audiences to choose which session to go to. We try and do a range so that if you're interested in business or you're interested in health or you're interested in politics or Jewish history or Holocaust history, there'll be sessions for your taste at different times.
And there are how many sessions before lunch? We have a lunch break. And
yes, so we have three sessions before lunch. We start at 9:30 with registration from 8:30. We have a lunch break at about 1 o'clock and then two sessions after lunch. So that's the 5x5 sessions. And then we will have drinks and a plenary with David Badil at the end of the day.
And you're ending on a nice humorous note.
On a high note,
I'm very,
yes,
very thrilled that Fine Music Radio, which is the only jazz and classical station in Africa, is your media partner in this event, because the Gittin Library, which is also a partner of yours, the Jacob Gittin Library, is the only Jewish library in Africa. So these things bring us all together for what I know will be an extraordinary good time together. How do you book?
So bookings are on Quicket. You can access the link through our website, which is jewishliteraryfestival.org.za.
That's easy enough. And you can also buy the tickets at certain times from the Jacob Gittin Library. Just give them a call and find out how and where.
Correct.
So yes. Lots of good reasons to get to the Jewish Literary Festival. And thank you to Vanessa Valkin and to Karen Gutkin. We'll be there.
These festival organizers put so much work into this festival. They bring in authors and big names from overseas. They curate some of the top authors in South Africa bringing out books right now. And then they have to figure out what panels to have and where to put them so that people can plan their day seamlessly and have an incredible and enlightening day at this festival on the 28th of April. I hope you got all the info that you need. You can find tickets, as they mentioned, on Quicket. And like I said, it's a really wonderful day out. There's just so much to enjoy. And that brings us to the end of Book Choice on Fine Music Radio for this week. I hope you'll join us again in 2 weeks' time for our Book Choice Publisher's Choice slot. And I hope you found something on this show that whets your appetite, that makes you want to curl up with a good book and have a really good read. My thanks to Exclusive Books for their sponsorship, and my big, huge thanks to you, our listener, for joining us. I so enjoyed meeting some of you at the benefit gala, at the Fine Music Radio benefit gala a couple of weeks ago. I met a few of our listeners and we were chatting about what you were reading, and it really meant a lot to me to put some faces to the listeners on the other side of the microphone. So thank you for coming up and saying hello, and thank you for listening to the show. And until next time, we're going to play out with Norwegian Wood by Tessa. And I wish you very happy reading, and I hope to see you at the Jewish Literary Festival on the 28th of April.